Gordon Liddy's My Muse, Mother Treason, 3. On to the Red Ace, the Dear Heart. It was 9 years later, the winter of 1969, when I used my make-believe return ticket to Russia. I was a junior classman at Haverford College, traveling once again with a Quaker peace mission. I once thought it devious to claim I'm a Yale man, a sci-fi spy alum, like Patrick Hale, 1778, and William Buckley, 1950. Tip was fooling, carried away by envy. He graduated tiny, suburban, Quaker-founded Haverford College, about 5 miles from where I was born, in Bryn Mawr Hospital. Back in 1969, Haverford College was not the precious little bundle of brains it is today. It was pink-blush liberal, waiting for Lefty to circle the dorms again, crying, "Stop the war." It was Peacenik U, so smugly righteous that the SDS was regarded as egalitarian. However, I was not persuaded by politics then, since I had only slogans. On campus, I was mashed potatoes, a language major jock who was not comfortable with either the many high-minded Marcuse vegetables who called drugs recreational, or the few low-minded meatheads who were my teammates, when they were not salting female pork chops. In 4 years, I joined no cause except football, lacrosse, and the Greek club's production of Aristophanes' nonsense. But then, that one winter, I did sign up for a Dove airlift to Moscow to search for peace in Vietnam. I was 20, toweringly gangly, with wire-rim eyeglasses and a cowlick, as over-serious as you can get before you become legally of age to vote and lose. Our peace mission was organized around the fairy tale that a Quaker named Richard M. Nixon was now in the White House, and it was proper for brother and sister Quakers everywhere to associate themselves with Mr. Nixon's secret plan to end the war. None of us college boys believed this. It was just a glib scam to secure alumni underwriting. Our motive was wanderlust, though there was the detail that Bryn Mawr girls were accompanying us. We 14 boy pilgrims, 5 Quakers, 4 Marxists, 2 Maoists, 2 space cadets, and Tip, arrived in Moscow after changing planes in Helsinki. The Bryn Mawr girls traveling with us arrive at approximately the same time at the front of the plane. What I'm saying is that it was profoundly not a co-ed enterprise. I was the veteran of our pack. I spoke better Russian than our hip junior faculty leader, Mike Miller. I spoke better French, German, Spanish, and American than our sweet in-tourist guide, comrade Miss Elena, who was waiting for us on the bus that slowly transferred us to the grandiose and elite Moscow Hotel off Red Square. I could detail Moscow for you like my present neighborhood, the Upper West Side. Why? What you need to know is that in February it is cold, snow-packed, and drab. When I was 11, it was another Philadelphia to me. When 20, it was profoundly other to me. Today, it's all prejudices. Some facts can be assembled. To be a great Russian is regarded as a privilege. To live in Moscow is regarded as God's blessing. To believe in God is regarded as superstitious and probably disloyal. Back then, 1969, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union was returned unchallenged to power for its 52nd year. A moody, backslapping hack named Leonid Brezhnev was the boss of bosses. He believed in nothing but keeping his job, hunting stag in the Urals, and drinking. The Communist Party's latest reigning theme was best defined as "Nothing goes, maybe." If comparisons help, their army was in Czechoslovakia with tanks and in deep trouble everywhere. Our army was in Vietnam with tanks and in deep trouble, etc. Brezhnev looked like the boss. Nixon did, too. Today I know 1969 better than any year since. The only genuine news that year was the moon race and my youth. We won the moon in July. I continued young. Add up the tanks, rockets, spacemen, and earthy girls and boys, you get another reel of the long-over-budget Cold War. If I'd written this then, I would have wasted words on the sensational details of our visit to Moscow. We collegians were a few of the very few Americans in Russia that year, either not under orders or AWOL. To idle in the lobby of the Moskva Hotel was to occupy ground zero target for Western philosophy. You could hear history quibbling. My compatriots ran off to the American embassy, the Vietnamese embassy, the Canadian embassy, curious that, and then to museums, the opera, the Kremlin. Hip Haverford prof Mike Miller said, "It's happening! Thomas, it's happening!" Tip, who pretended to be Thomas a few years ago, to shed high school Tommy, agreed. Frantic in tourist guide Alina said, "You must tell them the curfew is sincere, Comrade Payne. It's sincere." Tip, who liked whoever this Comrade Payne was, agreed. They were both right. It was also the Cold War. It remained very cold. I know now that I had as much chance to make sense of it as I did to make sense of Livia Logan, the long-nosed Bryn Mawr blonde who roomed three doors left of mine at the Moskva Hotel. In her way, Livia Logan was armored, fueled, moonstruck, expensive. My philosophical ground zero. On the third day, I tried a ceasefire in all directions and rang up the Pelicans. In 9 years, I had sent Trifia one Christmas card featuring a picture of my family, and this had been my mom's idea. Trifia had returned me one note featuring a photo of his family. I'm sure his mom's idea. I did not feel guilty about this. Adolescents shirk detail. When a young woman answered my call, I announced myself in crisp Russian. It was Marya, Trifia's baby sister, now a teenager, who began formally and then emoted, "Oh, Tipya, yes, yes, you're in Moscow, here. And Trifia, he's home now. You must come and see him. Trifia's always, he's always. You must come. I'm here with Papa now, he's sick. And Mama's at work, yes, the national. Go see her. We're the same, yes, the same." The Pelicans were not the same. Marya was not falsifying. She was hoping. I walked over to the National Hotel to call on Mama. My collegiate Russian upset the sentries, since I lacked a hotel pass. My intention upset the chief concierge, since order is the name of hoteliers. But soon enough, Mama appeared at the office. Her rosiness was gone. Her chubbiness was grown. Her questions were sharp. "Comrade Payne, why are you here?" "You called Marya?" "Yes, yes, Trifia's home from the army. Yes, a visit. It can be arranged. Tomorrow morning, call for me here." If this sounds suspicious, I missed it. The next morning, I rendezvoused with Mama again. She was relaxed, just off the overnight shift, and chatted pleasantly on the long metro and bus ride home. I caught her up on my last 9 years. She shared little beyond current Trifia news. He was home from Army service to begin school again. Mama was proud of Trifia in the abstract. She communicated displeasure in the specifics, such as, "He's not kept up with his English. He played hockey until he broke his foot. Too many little bones to mend. And your mama, she must be very proud of you. A peace mission again, it's good. Soldiering's also good, but now, you're President Johnson. Well, your Russian is excellent. How did you learn?" I corrected her only once. It was President Nixon now. She accepted the detail like a mama. "Politics," Mama said. "It's enough to care for the family. Don't you agree?" "Da, Mama. I love you." And when we arrived, I greeted the family with my proper Russian gift of bread and salt as soon as I walked in the kitchen. The Pelicans kissed and hugged me wholeheartedly. I appreciated the sweet Marya and the lovely older sister Katya, but I was keenest about Trifia. He was in uniform and looking like a poster. His boyish good looks had become obviously handsome. A chiseled face, coal ember eyes, curly black hair. I had outgrown him, but he was so gracefully fit that I felt ever more lumpy. He said, "Tipya, those eyeglasses, the Lenin scholar. See, Mama? Here's your professor at last." I heard instead, "Tipya, what happened?" Papa stayed in his sickbed, so E5 sat down to breakfast, served by Mama's mother, the remaining babushka. Russians eat heavily when they can, for the cold, and any meat or dairy product is a treat. The table that morning was indulgent. I did not mean to offend by refusing. It was just my nervous stomach. Mama asked, "You don't like meat and milk?" Trifia volunteered, "I'll eat his portion, Mama. No one will know." Mama shrugged. a maternal confusion, and spoke proverbially. The cock crows before he eats, too. Again, I missed the weight of the remarks. Trifia overwhelmed me with questions about fashion, starting with my clothes and travels, and moving then on to his favorite subject, movies. Do you go to the cinema, Tipya? Do you often see our cinema? No? What do you see? I answered quickly. I meant to entertain, not compete. I knew they wouldn't recognize the pretentious fads I listed. Bergman, Truffaut, Fellini, Bogart, McQueen, Sellers. Nor would they understand my joke that I'd felt foolish at Yellow Submarine. As I finished, Trippier was staring blankly, his sister's delayed breath. I summarized simply, just foreigners and tough guys. Peter Sellers was a silly guy. Mama said, "We have them, too." Trifia chomped another sausage and asked, "Tipya, no cowboys? You don't go to the cowboy movies? I've seen two now, Red River." Mama clanked cutlery, Trifia added, "about socialist brotherhood prevailing over capitalist exploitation. We went to it in last spring. And years ago I saw another John Wayne film, Fort Apache." Mama rose huffily. Trifia added, "about the massacre of the Native Americans by the capitalists." I ignored his politics, not inaccurate, just unclever, and said that he'd seen two of the best movies, westerns, ever made. Trifia's smile was victorious. After breakfast, when Mama had retired and the girls had gone off to school, we boys took a walk in the cold sun to philosophize about John Wayne. Trifia did not mention capitalism again. Who knew John Wayne was a monumental hero? Russian boys understand everything about heroism the moment they read Pushkin and Tolstoy. Soon we were far from his apartment, at his old school, standing with the brickworkers and watching schoolboys play ice hockey on the natural rink. "Tipya," he exclaimed, "you don't know how I've missed your stories. You don't know." This was tender, and for the first time I let myself see Trifia for what he was, a boy without much, in a country that permitted less. I said I was sorry we couldn't go to a cowboy movie festival right now. Trifia waved my wish away while introducing his twin surprises. The first was plenty. She came slipping across the ice from the school side, her fur cap flopping over her dark curls. She leaped into Trifia's bear hug and grinned her signature, a huge mouth under a Roman nose. "Oh, Trifia, you feel so good," she exhaled in Russian, then spoke to me in British English. "You don't remember me, Comrade Payne, but I do you. I'm Tina. I stood over there the day you helped Trifia score his goals." "She was a poor hockey fan," said Trifia, "but the school brain." He crooned, "my luckiest draw." "Brute," protested Tina, boxing his ears. The first time I actually saw this done. She corrected him in English to me. "I'm his affianced." I congratulated them in Russian. This got me a kiss from Tina and her proverb about Trifia. "He's got a boot flap for a tongue." I laughed with her, though Tina was much too smart to make simple jokes. She meant it menacingly, too. Russians think in proverbs. The best speak of truth, most of food and folly, the darkest of suffering. Tina was many facts. I only need to summate. Valentina Myrakova was a truth for a lifetime, a banquet for any fool, a person who knew suffering intimately, for she was also born a beautiful woman amid Russian misogyny, granted a good brain and an ornithology degree amid Russian cruelty toward the new man and the old wilderness, burdened with a sense of proportion and loyalty amid big bossness and petty horrors. In all, a dear heart who was so much in love with a lucky fellow that she stood by him past the end. That's many tomorrows. That day, Trifia demonstrated his second and most dangerous secret. "Sing that song, Tipya," he pleaded. "The Paladin song for Tina. Sing it. I could never remember the words." I stopped singing at 12, but I played along, speaking the translation. "Have gone, will travel," reads the card of a man. Tina applauded. Suddenly Trifia moved away from Tina, whipped his greatcoat back, and drew a deck of cards from a black pouch on his hip. He recited his own version of Paladin's ceremonial poetry. "You're the kind that always loses. Bliss and you are all at odds. You're too sweet when chance refuses, and too clever when it nods." He He shuffled the cards in the air like the card sharp he was and added, Alexander Pushkin, 1825. I was dumbfounded, not merely by his prowess, but also by the intensity of his make-believe. He was well out of Moscow, off the planet, what the word means, starbound. Tina pulled him back. Show off, she scolded. What kind of a host are you? Then to me, he's been waiting to do that for 9 years. Meanwhile, Trivia had fanned the deck inside and out, done that neat card trick of picking out whatever you want. He produced four aces. The wire paladin hand, he said. It never loses. But it's my experience you don't need it. Poker's more blissful than the odds. You offend Pushkin, chided Tina. Then to me, he's got a flap for a tongue, cards for wit. You don't need wit either, Trivia defended, if you're holding the high hand. The lover spat faded in our fun. I had three more days to play and was gritty like a lover since I was stuck on both of them. There were many things I should have seen about their lives, many questions I might have asked. Young Tip concentrated on enjoying himself. And one more vanity, being a show-off, too, and displaying my beautiful Russian pair to my peacenik compatriots. It was not easily done. Trivia was available to me during the days on compassionate leave from the army because his papa was dying of heart disease. But Tina's class schedule and institute job at Moscow University blocked her days. Nighttime was out. There was a perpetual curfew in Moscow then, especially for young soldiers, since a tanker on leave from Czechoslovakia had tried to assassinate Brezhnev in the Kremlin yard the month before. I proposed breakfast at Trivia's home and was rejected because Mama would not approve of strangers. I proposed supper, perhaps in my room, and was rejected because Trivia and Tina could not get into my hotel without a pass. Finally, on my last day in Moscow, Tina constructed a plan. There was a bakery near the university that daring students used as a bistro on the weekends. I asked if this still wouldn't be trouble for Trivia. Tina said, he's used to it. My collegians were ripe for the chance to meet Russian youth at last. In a week of peacemaking, they had been delimited to foreigners like themselves. Correctly, I didn't trust them. They smoked dope in their rooms and complained about the vodka. I aimed to travel to Moscow University loose-lipless. I had to tell our hip prof, Mike Miller, who recklessly invited his reckless new paramour, our in-tourist guide, Alina. Otherwise, I kept my guest list tight. I invited two guys I liked, Texas Space Cadet and Mark Weinstein, the pre-law Maoist, and of course I invited the lovely nymph Livia Logan, who did know my name. She used it twice when she agreed. Thomas? That'd be cool. Thomas? Turned out to be even more cool because she could bring along two girl pals. The proverb says it was worse than wrong. It didn't work. This applies to Leninism as well as it does to my expedition. It was stupid to lead hipsters into a Moscow bakery that was so deliciously hot with Russian yearning that the Cold War seemed burned out of the evening. Their side did fine. We capitalists acted out. It was a tiny space opening onto the ovens and the loading docks. The Russian kids used it to make romance. It was one of the very few places where they could go hang out free of envy's way, for they were the elite. They knew that. They were headed toward privilege. Unfortunately, my kindred of capitalism looked upon them as shabby state tech squares who needed cram courses and brand names. Soon, my compatriots were preaching the triumph of the free world via shopping sprees. Even Tex, who didn't know better, kept emphasizing to Trivia that he didn't like his jeans until they were grungy. Even Mark Weinstein, who did know better, said cigarette burns and a sweater made it better. The Bryn Mawr girls were agitprop in motion. They gave away all their makeup and started a seminar at the adjoining table on birth control devices versus the pill. When Mike Miller got rolling, he took on two Leninists about the superiority of American paper products. I felt ashamed. I was learning that when you dump Americans in desperate lands, you get TV Goes to Mars. Also, I could understand what the Russians were saying about us. Their proverbs broke down before their eyes. Learn good things, one girl said. The bad come out naturally. Yes, but how come? Asked another girl. The bad wore such beautiful shoes. We're related, said a boy. The same sun dries our rags. Yes, countered another girl, but why are their rags so pretty? There were also many curses for what we were, what we had, which the Russian kids knew they could never have, no matter how hard they worked, and yet we American fools treated it as disposable fads. The worst of it, though, and why I recount this episode, was with regard to Trifia and Tina. They glowed in their plainness. They addressed my friends as if they were my family. Trifia took to text, as I thought, and soon they were using Tina and me as interpreters for their sojourns along the Rio Grande. Tex said to me, "He's a cowhand, all right. Get the right duds on him, and I'd have him riding range in a week." I translated. Trifia misunderstood the duds reference and looked hurt. He was very proud of his uniform, a junior lieutenant in the Signal Corps. Tex tried to mend fences. "It's cool threads, man. Boss buttons and all. It's just not you." Trifia brightened eagerly, saying he wouldn't always be in uniform. Someday he'd have jeans and cowboy boots like Texas. Trifia brought out his cards to demonstrate his true talent, his card-sharp shuffle. Got the Bryn Mawr girl's rapt focus. Livia Logan had startled at Trifia's beauty immediately. I wasn't jealous, not truly. But then Trifia turned over his deck with one hand and said, in broken English, "Gentlemen, the game is poker." Golden Livia interrupted him like a vulgar princess. "Poker's a pig's game, man. Let me show you what cards are for." Trifia surrendered his cards to her amiably, but I knew he was shocked. I didn't have to explain the pig reference. Today that would be matcha with more bite. Livia and her two pals surrounded Trifia to read his cards for him. I moved over to entertain Tina, who was trying not to scowl at Livia Logan. Russian women bypass jealousy for strangling. Tina patiently pretended to be telling me about the falcon population of Greater Moscow while she recorded every seductive word directed her Trifia. Mark Weinstein crowded in to flirt with her. Again, Tina patiently pretended to listen. But when Livia and Crony sighed once too often, Tina spoke hotly to me. "If that's what he likes, powder and breasts," said Tina. "I can do that, too." Mark Weinstein drew back from her fury. Tina switched to proverbial Russian to me. "The church is far. The road is icy. The tavern is farther. I'll walk carefully." "Do you understand, Tipya? I can be church and tavern both. He'll never leave me. Never." I apologized for my serpent of a date. I explained that card reading was an old college girl game. Tina said, "The cards are what he loves. I must love them, too." She laughed. "I'm his luckiest draw." "Yes, Tina, you were all of that. Body, belief, and draw of joy. The ace of hearts. You were also very, very smart. I can guess that Trifia would never have got so far on that icy path if you hadn't been with him. Why didn't you stop him? I know the answer. You loved him no matter what he did. But still, why? I guess I'm just looking for a way to help you now."